Rabba Mine. In other words, he gets the death penalty, which is the most severe penalty, which is Miso. He ain't been Malkos. And if he gets the death penalty, he's not going to get Malkos. They're not going to schmeiß him at the same time and kill him.
Every death.
All right. But Kol Kemine, Mitmiya, this is a question. How could he even imagine the possibility of what? Of going on his own and asking somebody else, you know, offer to marry her. The Chil call him, you know, it is all dependent upon him, that she can be betrothed by this guy's, you know, receiving a marriage proposal.
It's an unusual usage of the word Kol Kemine. Usually Kol Kemine is, do we believe him? Here it means Kol Kemine, is this within his power?
This is the real meaning.
Is it?
Yeah. Kol Kemine means im zem imenu. In other words, can it be dependent upon him?
Mm-hmm.
This is really what Kemine means. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Hanicha l'mand omar, according to the opinion it says, and it says, Pluktahi, this is a difference of opinion, but Basech is given, the Hashaleach get, and the Perik Hashaleach get. So, what do we say? We say, you know, that if she decides what? That she doesn't want this guy anymore and she's willing to accept the marriage proposal, then in that case, as we said before, he would be off the hook and so on, okay? But otherwise, he doesn't have the power, you know, to do anything like that. So, now, Aldas Rabim. This is what we were saying before. In other words, Madvira Barabim simply means that he made a public announcement. But what is Aldas Barabim? So he says, Shabotsuba Oboin. He comes and he says to everybody, you know what? I find that she committed a sin. Obviously, what is he accusing her of? Of adultery, obviously. Shasuelo, in which case she now becomes prohibited unto him, right? The Hiddi Raw, and so he made a nader against her, Aldas Rabim, Yadas Bezdin, both with the consent of the multitude and also with the consent of the Bezdin. In other words, if they agree that, you know, he really has something in that particular case, then his vow has validity, okay? So, so Nador, so it says, yes, okay.
Now you really
right.
In this case, if he makes, he's still married to her, is this corrupt or he's divorced from her? He's divorced from her?
He's not divorced from her, but the point is, he's not obligated to live with her anymore if everybody agrees that her conduct was such that, you know, it's wonderful. Obviously, we're having a case over here, not where she was found, as we were saying, flagrante delicto, you understand? In other words, caught in the act itself, but where there are suspicions, you know, people have seen her acting in such a way that it's there were grounds to suspect.
I guess what I'm driving at is this, at this stage, they're divorced, and the question is.
They're not divorced.
They're
not divorced because he's taking a vow against her
while
she's still his wife. While she is still his wife. We're finished with the other business.
We're finished about with his their being divorced and his refusing to take her back, remarry her as people of all people.
That's right, correct. But a new angle has been brought in. The new angle is now if it takes a netter against her, he says, I refuse to live with her. Okay? So in that case, what do we say?
And that's equivalent to
right.
divorcing her.
Of course, it's equivalent, but at the same time, the actual divorcement has not taken place, you see. A man does it. I would say that this, in general, has nothing to do with the case of the Ones, even. This is just a general application. If a man says that I hereby take a nader that I refuse to live with my wife, okay? So
on what? On the grounds of suspected.
On the grounds I don't like this woman.
Is it
okay? That's Madvira Barabin. He says, I want everybody to know that from this point on I refuse to live with my wife. Doesn't say I'm divorcing my wife, but I refuse to live with my wife. Okay?
And
I want everybody to know
it. Not talking about the inus.
Huh?
How can you say it's not talking about the inus anymore? It's still,
but
still trying to come
say,
up with the
right, correct. They are applying it to the inus.
Right.
But what I'm saying is that in general, it could also be applied even if the man were not an inus.
Yeah, that.
If a man says that I take a neder, then I'm not going to live with my wife. Okay?
Then he has no problems.
What do you mean he has
no
problem?
He's not
an
inus, then there's no problem at all. Anybody
No. But can he, for example, take a neder against something which the Torah says specifically that he's not allowed? That's where we bring it in. You see,
I would say it wouldn't be a problem. If he's not an inus, then taking a neder like this is equivalent to an obligation to divorce her. And since he's entitled to divorce her, I don't see that the neder is a problem.
Yeah, but he doesn't go through with the actual divorce.
Okay, the divorce is not... So it's right. It's a problem even in a standard marriage. But Allah has common
possibility
of an inus
yugirish. Of course. Look, don't you have cases of what we call separation today?
Mm-hmm.
Right? What is separation? Well, no, it's
still
something
married.
Like that.
It's still married.
They're still married. He's still required to a certain extent, let's say, to support, if not her, then certainly the children or something like that, right?
But the language talks about her being an asura. So asura would imply it's just not he decides.
Okay.
Right. You're saying that there is a suspicion.
Yeah.
In that case, the question I guess I'm driving at is, wouldn't this be resolved through Sota? In other words, if there is something to it, fine. Nader might be valid. But if they investigate her and there's nothing to it, then it won't hold.
Okay. The point that they make is a very valid point. In other words, the overtone or the undertone, whatever you wish, is really similar to the case of the Sota. Okay, but what I'm trying to make a distinction first is that we get clear in our mind what is the difference between Madira Barabim as compared to Madira Aldas Rabim. Madira Barabim simply means that it makes a public statement that I refuse to live with my wife. Then in that case, what do we say? We say that Yesh Hapor, in other words, you can annul such a statement. Okay? But Madira Aldas Rabim means that everybody agrees with him, including even the Beis Din, that his neder is a valid neder because of the fact that she's a woman of very
poor reputation,
and then in that case he's not obliged to live with her.
Publicly, no.
Right, but he has not divorced her. Simply that he's not living with her anymore, okay? And he's not violating the Torah, which says that a man has to live with his wife.
I'm interested in how this comes up, because what happens if a woman is brought as a sota, which this really...
That is the undertone, but I agree with you. Yeah.
All right. What happens if she's brought to the sota and found innocent? What is one of the punishments that the man is subject to?
The punishment in that case is that
he has to keep her.
He hasn't divorced her, but he has to keep her.
Exactly. So how does
and Mitzvah Shem, she should be able to conceive and bear a child, and everything will be
hunky dory.
Yes.
What he's trying to say, it's a conflict with what you're saying.
Right. There's a conflict in that respect. Because here the hope with the sota will be, that things are going to work out well if the woman is actually innocent of the charges, right? But here, as I say, something has happened.
It's implied that she is.
Let's say maybe that there was one witness who saw her, in a hotel. Okay? So the question is whether one witness would be valid in the Beis Din. Remember some time ago we had a case where they quoted the Gemara in Pesachim over there that Tuvia Chata, right? And the Zigud Nagde, which means what? Tuvia was the one who sinned, right? He committed a sin. Did something that wasn't right. And he deserved Malkus, right? But who got the Malkus and said? Zigot got the Malkus. Why did Zigot get the Malkus? So the Gemara and the Pesachim explains why. Because he went and he testified as a single witness against Tuvia. And you're not allowed to. You have to have at least two witnesses in order to prove, you know, that a sin, a violation has taken place, and then something can, punishment can take place. But he was punished, Ziggur was punished because he violated that by coming only as a single witness. Okay? So I say, all right, let's say that there's a single witness who says that I saw this woman in the motel with so and so. Okay? Single witness cannot disqualify her. And that is, cannot, right.
Cannot convict her.
Right. Cannot convict her of the death penalty for, let's say, for adultery. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. But what can the Beis Din say? The Beis Din can say, the husband says, I refuse to live with her anymore. And everybody will agree that in that particular case, his vow is valid. Okay? This is
Dira. Huh? He's absolved of his.
That case, undoubtedly, he would also be free from paying the ksuba, right? Because if she is suspected, then she is mafsid the ksuba, right?
She's mafsid on the basis of 1A.
Yeah, yeah.
So the neder is going to take place after the deal. This is what you're saying.
Yeah, because it's said over here. Rashi stressed not just Hadas Rabim, which would mean, you know, that everybody was in agreement that this was the right thing, but also it says V'aldas Beis Din, which is the even more important statement that Rashi is making over here. Okay, I think we shall stop at this particular point. So we're 5 lines from the bottom over here. It is, but Baruch Hashem, even if we go slowly, but at least we should try to understand,
nobody,
you know, what's going on. Right. You're right.
Why shouldn't they? Shouldn't that be a problem?
No.
I couldn't find anybody discussing the problem.
Right, but they haven't discussed it over here. They will get around to it.
Right. Do they relate this?
You simply make it impossible to fulfill.
Right.
We're talking about bitlo velo bitlo, essentially. Because kiyum over lo kiyum, there's no problem. If this is what you believe in, then it's simple. Either you do what the Beis Din tells you to do, or you get malchus, right? But if you believe in bitlo velo bitlo, so how can you have a case of being bitlo, right, as long as you didn't make it impossible for, you know, the affirmative action to take place which would rectify this? You understand?
I follow all of this. I follow the fact that they finally have come up with a bitlo, another example, the second example of bitlo, below bitlo, in a man that makes a, I guess you say nader is really the best.
Right. It's exactly what Madi Rom means. Yes, so he did wrong.
Woman,
yeah.
Which is unconditionally, you know, removes the possibility of fulfilling a certain service of rectification. But the original case was that of a onus who's going to rectify his divorce of the woman. And the bilo we were looking for is what he could do that would make it impossible for him to remarry. And
correct,
since murder would not be really applicable, this was another situation.
So we suggested that maybe, you know, he would. So the Gemara question is, how is it possible? How can he actually be mevatel, you know, by saying, look, I got a marriage proposal for you from somebody else. Can't do it. It's not in his power to do it. Okay? That's the call community.
I'm missing something here.
Yeah.
Even that's... Oh, okay, no. That is where she's divorced and he comes around and acts as shadchan. Alright?
Right.
That can't be done.
Right.
But here...
Of course the implication is that he must remarry her. Okay?
But here... Yeah. When he's bringing her to suspicion, we all agree it's while he's married to her.
Correct.
In which case, there's no case. I mean,
right.
If he's married to her, there's no problem of her being divorced and his he's making it impossible to remarry her. You follow? There's no case here.
I follow very good. But then again, we're going to come into the other problem that Mike Rosen raised, namely, how can you make a neder against what the Torah specifically states? You can't do that. You cannot go and violate something which is, you know, which is written specifically in the Torah. Can't do it. Okay.
Except they try to say, find him out that if she's suspected of adultery, it came close to being convicted. It's only a lack of a second witness.
Yeah. Right. Whatever it may be. Yeah.
Then that gives sufficient grounds. Not to do so. That I.
Right.
But he can't divorce.
And also, I just don't understand the zika between this and the onus. It doesn't make sense. If he's still married to her, there's no.
This is why I said it could apply more than just the onus. So there could be a general idea. Can a person make a neder against his wife? Okay.
Yeah.
That's why I brought it in. Yeah. Even though you know we're talking about you know the onay specifically, but nevertheless we could still say you see that the best thing can say to the onay, look my friend, you must remarry her. The divorce is no good. You must remarry her. But we don't say that you have to live with her because of the fact that the neder that you took not to live with her is a neder that we agree with wholeheartedly because of the fact that, you know, she's a woman who...
it's questionable.
Character. Okay.
Is it possible that he could go, could this be the solution, that he could go make a neder based on a... I don't know, that they saw her either when she was married to somebody else, which would, that would cancel out everything.
No, if she went and married somebody else, then forget
about
it.
Okay. If she,
forget
if
about
she's
it. Because in that case, as we said, Mevatla,
right?
She is the one who made Batla. In that case, he doesn't get any malkus.
Okay.
That's
okay.
All.
He's
off the hook.
Right, he's off the hook.
Is
it possible, what if she is alone, but she acts in a promiscuous manner, openly notorious manner, and he makes this accusation, and he says because of this, after this is shown before the Beit Din, because of this, I cannot live with her, I cannot remarry her.
So this is what I'm saying. Then the tactical ruling might be as follows, okay? I mean, I'm not the best at right now.
Right.
But we really have two different conflicting ideas, right? One is that according to the Torah, he's not allowed to divorce her. So if he divorced her, what must he do? He has to remarry her.
Correct.
But at the same time, his obligations as a husband are suspended by the Beis Din because of the fact that she is a very questionable character, and they agree that under those circumstances, if he made a neder that he refuses to live with her, even though he's married to her, then
that
in that particular case,
so he's he's absolved only because of the question.
But the divorce is no divorce.
Not divorce.
Right.
He still has to
remarry her because the Torah says that he is not allowed to divorce her as long as he lives. Okay.
Because he brought a statement against her, which he wasn't proven.
Right.
Now you've really lost me. In other words,
rape a woman who is a virgin.
Right, right.
Okay, you have to marry her, you have to give her father compensation, okay?
Right.
And you're not allowed to divorce her.
Great.
So now what we're talking about is, he divorced her, in spite of what the Torah said, right? He violated the law of the Torah.
And then it's proved that she's a promiscuous woman. Not a woman that a man wants to remarry.
Yeah.
But he's under the obligation to remarry her.
So he has to remarry her, but with the consent of the court, as well as public opinion, he can say, okay, I have to marry her I have to stay married to her because the Torah says so, okay?
Right.
But, nevertheless, I'm making an oath right now that I refuse to have anything more. I refuse to live with her as husband and wife.
Okay. That gets you out of Michael Rosen's problem with not providing the three conditions of marriage.
Right.
But it also doesn't, it's not vetoed, but won't veto because he's, again, the court is forcing him to remarry. So
yeah, correct.
He didn't set up the situation.
So he wasn't levatal as a result.
Right.
That's
wasn't,
correct.
Right, exactly.
He wasn't levatal. Right. So in that case, would he get Malchus?
So it isn't a case where
so he wouldn't get Malchus, according
right.
to this opinion.
He wouldn't get Malchus. We haven't found a second case where
right.
he...
Right. So that, therefore, we're going to discard this case
right.
and go to another case.
Right.
To
right.
see whether we can apply this principle. Okay?
Right. Yes.
So
absolutely.
Far, the only case that we came up with is
the original
the
one.
Case of Shiluach HaKein. Okay?
Right, right.
Well, yeah, it was a Cain can't remarry her, that's it.
No, Shiluach HaKein is to set the mother bird free.
Oh, set the mother bird free, all
right.
Yeah,
if,
yeah,
not
yeah.
if he killed the bird.
Okay.
Okay.
yeah, right. That's
right.
Doctors, let me pay you for the
Zion.
Shahar, okay?
And,
No, seriously.
Test Zion, on Olive.
Okay.
And we'll meet, this is
yeah,
April
today,
17th.
We'll be meeting in May next week, huh?
Yep, right.
Okay.
24.
I'll
we'll
be
on the 24th.
I'm so used to the Jewish calendar that I have to relate now to the secular calendar.
Okay.
We are on Test Zion, the bottom of the page, four lines from the bottom.
And that's
okay.
April 24th, 1996.
Correct. All right. So the Gemara says, Mesulek, oh, that's the fifth line, okay, from the bottom. It says, tell me, and are there no other cases, you know, where what? Well, we've been arguing all this point all the time, right? Namely, there is one point of view that says, Kimo, below Kimo, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the court says to him, you have to do this, and if he didn't obey what the court said, then in that case he's liable to Malchus, the flogging. That's one point of view. On the other hand, we have the other point of view, which says bitlo velo bitlo. In other words, bitlo velo bitlo implies that the court has no right to give him Malchus until he actually made it impossible to ever carry out rectifying mitzvah, you know, for the love which he committed, right? Because we've been talking in general about different negative commandments which can be rectified by an affirmative commandment, okay? But where he made it impossible to carry out the affirmative commandment, then in that particular case, then he would get Malchus for it. As we pointed out, the case, for example, of setting the mother bird free, right? That if he killed the mother bird,
the way it was rectified.
Well, they can't rectify it. So in that case, he gets Malchus for violating that particular law. Okay? So the question is then, are there any other cases where it is possible, you know, that, let's say, Bitlo and Old Bitlo is going to be carried out? Yes.
But in that case, he has endless amount of time to do the positive thing to correct the negative commandment.
Yeah, as long as he didn't make it impossible to do so.
That's right. He can do it.
Correct.
10 years from now, 20 years from now.
That's right. That's right. That's what we learned in the case of the Yonis, right? Yeah, exactly what it is. Okay. Bitlo v'lo bitlo stresses the impossibility, right?
Yeah.
That point of view, correct? Okay. So they say there are no other cases. There must be. Well, I brought this on, remembers a statement about Rabbi Yochanan, who said, you know, that this case, referring to the Shiluach HaKein, right? And there's one other case, he says, where it's possible. And they're going through case after case to see what could the other case possibly be. Okay? So, they come up with three suggestions at this point. The Hoyika, and there are. And as you can see, they put it over there, Simon. In other words, yes?
No, I'm just trying to find point.
Yeah, well, you put line from the bottom. Simon is Gezel, Mashkein, Upeya. In other words, a little mnemonic device to help you remember what are the next three cases that they're going to discuss. Because remember, again, all this was done orally.
Mm.
And so they needed certain mnemonic devices in order to try to remember the order in which it happened and in what area, you know, was this discussion taking place and so on. All right. So the first case is Gezel. What is Gezel? Gezel, of course, is robbing. Okay?
Goslin. Goslin is a
robber.
Right.
The Goslin is a robber, right. A highway robber is a Goslin, right. From the point of view of Halacha, they distinguish between a Goslin and a Gonifus, you know.
Really?
And in fact, you have, you know, the two expressions in the Torah. One of them is, don't take no, you're not allowed to steal, right? And then it says, the lo sigzol, and you shall not rob. Okay, so they technically there is a distinction between them in that a ganav is somebody who breaks into a house in order to do it. Okay? A gazlan is somebody who holds you up. Threatens you with a knife, a gun, or something like that. Okay? So that, but here they're really using it. But here they're using it, I would say, in a general way. I mean, in other words, you're not allowed to steal, okay? I guess one is called stealing, the other one is called robbing.
Robbery is taken by force. You can steal without force.
Your
example is a perfect one.
So the Torah says lo sigzol, right? Not allowed to steal. Alright. But what happens if you steal? So afterwards the Torah says Veheshiv is hagzela, that he shall restore that which he has stolen, you know, to the owner. Okay? Veheshiv is hagzela livolof. This is the complete expression, okay? Of course, since we're talking about the difference between a ganav and a goslin, you know, the goslin is only required to pay back what he has stolen or the monetary value thereof. That's the goslin. But the ganav has to do what?
He has to
pay back double. Exactly. Yeah. Right. So, you know, the Gemara asks, you know, why? Why should the ganav, you know, have to pay double, whereas the goslin only pays one? So the answer is as follows. An interesting answer psychologically. It says the goslin, he does what he does openly. He shows that he has no fear of God, right? And he has no fear of man. And so therefore, but what is the ganav doing? The ganav shows that he has fear of man, and that he breaks into the house stealthily, right, in order to steal what he's stealing. But at the same time, it shows that he has no fear of God by doing, you know, by disobeying it. So that, therefore, this is the reason why they say he has to pay back double. It's a very interesting
concept.
To rectify what?
Well, in either case, they have to rectify. I mean, he's caught. He has to make good.
No, but I mean, psychologically, what? To rectify, to try to stimulate in him a fear of God like the fear of man? I mean, why?
Even more. Although we have a Gemara in Brachos that we learned a long time ago, which says that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to his students, he says, that Halavai says that the fear of God would be within you the same as you fear man, you see. And, you know, normally we expect that people would fear God more than they fear man, but that's right, you know, but that's a psychological truth, you know. For man, we're afraid we'll be seen by the other person, so we refrain from doing things. But we don't have always the same attitude towards the Rebbeinu Shalem.
The brigands, they feel they're beyond redemption, or what? I mean, they're beyond...
No, we're not talking about that.
Well, okay, but I mean, why somebody that's brazen and holds you up?
Right.
I'm asking.
He still has to restore, but he only restores what he has stolen.
There's no penalty.
Okay, right, but he's not penalized by the double penalty. That's the point.
That there's no punishment.
Right.
No, not that there's
no
punishment.
No,
we're going to broaden it.
You're correct. In other words, a person who steals has to make good what he has stolen,
right,
but he's not given jail time for it.
Well, that's
I think what you're referring to.
Yes,
right. That's absolutely right.
Pays double.
Yeah,
he's in the same thing. He just
right. He has to make restitution.
Restitution,
exactly.
But no jail.
Right, exactly.
Why? Because he operates in stealth, or because he shows fear of men? Why the double?
As I said, the double penalty is because it shows that he had less regard for the Rebbeinu Shalom
than for human beings.
Okay.
I think I'd be getting this.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing for the man. He's committed a crime, but then he just gave it back and nothing happens. Whether even if he paid double, nothing happened.
Well, nevertheless, in itself, it could be a deterrent. That's number one. He knows at the same time.
He just could go and do it again and say, well, I need to, this time I got caught. So I
yeah, but it's still, he is violating a law in the Torah. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
Okay?
That's
he's violating a law in the Torah.
Right. And also, if he doesn't, if he spent it already, then the Beit Din can sell him as a slave
for the
amount of the restitution.
Correct.
That,
right.
that
right.
would be a big lesson.
Right.
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 Sure, but that's no penalty.
Being a slave?
Really?
Being a slave?
Oh, I didn't hear that part. Right. I thought you said that they gave him time to pay.
No, the person, right.
Sell him as a slave.
The man who stole.
He
spent it all and he hasn't had anything left, you know.
Or he gave it away, whatever.
Right. So in that case, the court could sell him into slavery for the period of 6 years.
Right. 6 years.
Okay. Because he's an evident Ivri, I mean.
At least that answers my question. That's a punishment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, that would be a punishment, correct. Or to the extent, you know, that he's sold into slavery until the point that he works off what it is that he has stolen.
Yeah.
You understand?
Right.
I mean, the idea is not to keep him in slavery, but the idea is that he should work off the amount of money that he has stolen. And
under Jewish law, the slaves get paid?
A slave does not get paid. You can give a matana if you wish to a slave, but he does not get paid for his services. On the other hand, you are obligated to support him, his wife, his children, and to support him in the style of living that he was accustomed to before. And you cannot make him do work which is considered degrading, either.
Like selling manure in the pasture, right?
Whatever it may be, different things, you see. There are all kinds of hedges as far as slavery is concerned. This is what we learned in Gemara and Kedushin.
So if he doesn't get paid, how can he pay himself out? He can buy himself out.
For the value of his work.
The value of his work, right. In other words, it could be estimated that, let's say, if he were working as a hired laborer.
I see. Okay.
How much would this labor be worth?
I understand.
Okay.
I understand.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's modern day stuff too.
Right, right. A great deal of these laws really make a lot of sense today too.
Right.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Okay.
Okay.
Lo sigzol.
Yeah. So in the first case then the Torah says lo sigzol, don't steal, and then it says leisha sagzel. So we see already what? That there is something to rectify your violation, right? All right, so the question is, of course, I mean, then how are we going to get about a situation where it's going to be bitlo, right? Where he destroys that possibility of giving it back.
Right.
All right, but we hold that in abeyance. Mashkon is something that is given as a pledge. Okay? You borrow money, okay? And you offer a pledge as security for it. Okay? So, what is the ruling of the Torah in that case? The Rachmon Omar, the Torah said, Lo sabol beiso la'avot avoto. You're not allowed to enter the house of the person in order to collect your pledge. It says it's written, Bachutz ta'avod, you have to stand outside the house, and then he will bring you out the pledge. You understand? Of course, again, what is the reason behind it? Obviously, it's in order to preserve the self-respect of the person, you know, who had to borrow the money and who's offering the pledge. If you don't go into his house, at least he can be his balabos in his own house,
right,
and he retains the self-respect. But what does the Torah say in the case of a person, you know, who wants his pledge? It says, Hoshek Toshiv Lo. You have to return it to him. Of course, specifically there in the Torah, it speaks about, let's say, if you have as a pledge a garment or a blanket or something like that, something that a person needs at night. So in that case, you have to return it by sunset because that person needs it in order to be able to sleep through the night, you see. So again, it's in order to preserve his self-respect. Right, you have to return unto him the pledge as the sun is setting. So he says, Umash kachat lo, we can find that bikiyimo velo kiyimo, uvitlo velo vitlo. We can find that both interpretations can be sustained in this case. In what way? If it's kiyimo velo kiyimo, as we already said, the Besdin says to you, look, this is what you have to do, and do it immediately, and he refuses to do it, and in that case we learn, he gets Malchus word. Okay? So that's kiyimo velo kiyimo. Bitlo, as we learned, they'll give you time to do it, but if you make it impossible to do it, then in that particular case, then you get Malchus, because you can no longer rectify what you've done wrong. It says, Kosom, over there, in other words, in these cases, Kevin the Chai B'tash Lubin, Ein Loke Mishalek. We established a principle long time ago when we first started the first chapter of Malchus of Kedei Rishosa. In other words, he gets Malchus only in accordance with the wickedness that he has performed, right? But we learned at that time that the way Rabbi Akiva and others, you know, interpreted since Kedei Rishosa, that you can only give him one penalty, right? But not Shtei Rishios. You cannot give him two penalties for the same offense. Okay. So what do we learn over there? There we learn that there's a basic principle of either loka the inu mishale, either right, he gets malchus and he doesn't pay the monetary, or the opposite. If you pay the penalty, if you pay what you owe, then in that particular case you're not going to get malchus for it. So this is what he's saying over here. Here he says, look, in the case of what we've just mentioned, namely the gezela, right, whether it's robbery or whether it's returning the mashkon, returning the pledge, right? In either case, it actually is monetary in nature, okay? So, ein loka, right, umishalim. Then in that case, what? He won't get malchus, but instead, what will he do? He'll pay, that's all. So now along comes an objection. Right. Subtitle A. Well, it's not too bad. An objection. Matzkeflav Rabbi Zera. So Rabbi Zera disagrees with this opinion, because if we say Ein Lokel Mishalim, then it means how can he get Malkis? He's not getting any Malkis. Correct? Not getting any Malkus, because even if, let's say, if he destroyed the mashkon, okay, let's say he destroyed it and can't give it back, but how does he get out of giving Malkus? Gives back the monetary value, whatever it was. He gives
If the creditor destroys the mashkon,
right,
that doesn't hurt the debtor, am I right? I guess you would say, I'll take that back.
But the debtor should be getting back his mashkon.
Right.
Okay?
Forget what I said.
What's the mashkon?
The mashkon is the pledge that he took.
Oh. It's like a promissory note, yeah.
Well, it's not a note.
It's a material
object. Right, it's an object of value. Okay? It's an object of value.
Yeah.
But we said it has to be returned to the debtor, correct?
Yeah.
All right, so let's say he destroys this mashkon. In that case, we would say he should get Malkus, right? But the Gemara says no, because this is a monetary affair. And the monetary affair, the usual ruling is that it's loka. I mean, ain't a loka. He doesn't get Malkus, but the Mishon. He simply pays the value of what it is that he destroyed.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Can you explain once more?
Kiyimo velo kiyimo means the court says to you, you gotta do this immediately. Okay? Like, for example, the case of the old days. The guy, the man who raped the virgin and so on, and then he divorced her afterwards. Okay? So they say to him, you must remarry her. Right now. Okay? If he refuses to do it, then the court has the right to give him Malkus. That's the opinion of Kiyimo v'lo Kiyimo, okay? So over here too, If the court says to him, look, you destroyed an object of value belonging to the guy, all right, granted, you know, that he borrowed money from you, but where do you have the chutzpah to go and to destroy a thing of value that belongs to him, essentially?
I mean, it's collateral.
Right, the collateral.
See, that's what,
so in that case, pay the money, right, pay the money that it's worth, okay?
Right.
And you don't get malchus.
Okay. So when I guess what it goes through, actually I had to study this for the Barzin. They have actually a pledges law, you know, but it's complicated. They have all kinds of, you know, if you have foodstuffs and whatever, there are all kinds of laws governing what you can do, what you can't do. Now, I'm wondering, are they talking about the situation where the debtor, he gives the pledge, right? And he pays back the money that he owes.
No, the debtor.
And then the creditor
just
out of malice destroys his.
Destroys the mashkin.
Yeah, would seem to be
no question that he has to pay for the value of the mashkin.
Okay.
But even if the debtor had not yet paid back, he had no right.
Then it belongs to the creditor. Then, right? If he doesn't pay at all, and there's no hope of paying, then the pledge would belong to the creditor, and he can use it up. If it was like a guy pledged a vineyard, he could use all the fruit, he could use it up.
But David, we forgot one thing.
What?
And that is that if this is going to be the case, he has to come to the Beis Din, and the Beis Din doesn't have to make that decision. He doesn't have the right to do it on his own.
Yeah, maybe you're right, because that's in the law too, right. Yeah, he'd have to...
The court would have to say to him, look, you know, he can pay, all right, he pledged this and this, okay, then we authorize you to seize the pledge.
Okay, that's it, seize the pledge,
to
you
seize
could
the
eat
pledge.
The fruit, or you could sell the fruit,
right,
you could even
right.
sell the vineyard.
Right.
But you're right, he would have to come to the Beis Din.
Right. But to go and to deliberately destroy the pledge even before the other fellow had an opportunity to pay back.
But that would be, he'd be working against his self-interest there.
Okay, right. But we're trying to think in terms of how could bitlo below bitlo possibly take effect over here, right? So we say, okay, bitlo, he destroyed the pledge, okay. But even so, then why shouldn't he get
he could, right?
But the answer is that he's not going to get malchus because it's a monetary business and he can pay back the amount of money, you know, that this is worth.
But you understand about
Cain? Or he could forgive the debt, the original debt.
That's already a different
story. Right,
sure he could.
You got to collect right away.
Yeah, right.
If he received the mashkon for a debt,
yeah,
right, and then from some, I don't know, crazed act, he decides he's going to destroy his own security, his own collateral without being paid, all right? So they say, okay, now that's beat low. He can't, now if the man pays him, he can't give it back, all right? So they say now, well, it doesn't matter because he could just give him the value of the mashkon.
Right.
But what he could also do is just forgive the debt.
Right.
Because the debt was, the original debt was in exchange for the mashkon, right?
Yeah, right.
That's another way you could do it.
Yeah. By the way, Rashi says, how was it beat low? Let's say that the debtor gave a garment as a pledge. So
right.
This
right.
guy went and he burned it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's bitlo, okay? But as I say, it could be in any way. I'm just telling you how Rashi understands, you know. But it's a general principle. And if he destroys the mashkin, he should get malchus? No. Doesn't get malchus according to this because ain't loka. It's not going to get malchus because he has to pay for the value of it. So make it good.
Buy him a new permit,
right. Buy him a new one or give him the money in order to buy a new one, whatever this was worth. I don't know if they take off depreciation or not.
Or as I keep saying, say you don't have to pay me back so you can use the money to buy a new one.
Right. So. All right. Anyway, Matzkefo Rabbi Zeira. So Rabbi Zeira objected to this. He says, I can give you a case. He says, so Ikoth. There is the case of what? Mashkono shel ger v'meis. Let's say a person was a ger. In other words, he converted to Judaism, okay? And then, you know, he lent money, let's say, to somebody, right? And that other person over there to whom he lent the money, so, you know, he's supposed to pay back the mashkin. Right?
Uh-huh.
But what happened?
The
girl lent the money. Okay. Right. The girl lent the money. Okay. Right. It's a nice guy, and so on and so forth. Now, the girl dies.
Right.
Okay. So now the question is, if the girl married and had children, there's no question. He has an estate. Mm-hmm. You understand? So to whom does the mashkin have to go, you know, in case the court says, hey, the guy never, you know, paid back and so on?
He didn't pay back. Didn't pay back.
Right.
Okay.
So that therefore the court could authorize that, you know, that originally that the girl could get the mashkin, but since the girl is no longer alive, then in that case, his yorshim, right?
Right.
His heirs would do it. But let's say he died without ever having married and not having any child. Then in that case, what happens to it?
He has no children at all.
No.
No. It goes to his next kinsman. But his next kinsmen aren't Jews, right? Is that the problem?
It's correct.
Hey, dead end. Right. Okay.
Dead end.
Right. Correct.
Leaves nowhere, so now he now what happens?
Right. Mashkanush Hagir makes Hagir, right?
Right.
Hagir died. So in that case, so they say, Hatsam Gavrabat Hashlaminhu, right? Look, it says, the guy deserves to be paid, right? Vishibudo the Gir Hudikopaka. And under normal circumstances, the Shibuda, which means, you know, the amount of money that is pledged that has to be paid, you know, would be. But what has happened here, since he died without an heir at all, there's nobody, you know, to
pay to.
Right? Then in that case, it's gone. The obligation has been dissolved. So in that particular case, he's not going to get Malkus, even though he did not fulfill the fact that he was supposed to pay back the money to the Ger, right?
Right.
He was supposed to pay back the money to the Ger.
Yes, I understand.
Okay. The Ger died before he could pay back.
Right.
And the Ger has nobody to inherit him.
Right.
Okay? So what is he going to do? So he says, are we going to say therefore that he should get Malkus because he should have, and now it's impossible to fulfill the obligation that he had?
Yeah, well, you know, it'd be irrational.
You understand? Yeah.
So therefore we say no,
because it's the death of the Ger that made it impossible.
Right.
The obligation. This is the whole Iko Payoff. Okay, so they say, all right, how about the case of Payoff? Payoff, if you remember, is that you have a field, you have to leave the corner of the field, a corner of the field for the poor people. So that technically belongs to whom? To the poor people. Okay? Now what happens if you reap the entire field so that there was nothing left for the poor people? You should get Malkus, right?
No, you can pay the monetary value.
So this is what they're going to come up with. Exactly. And that's why they grouped these three together. That we thought, you know, maybe, but it's not going to work that way. Right.
Yeah, but you can pay it. You can use it.
We'll see in a second. Okay. All right. We'll see in a second. All right. The Rachmono Amar, the Torah says what? Lo sechala pa'asotcha. Right. You're not allowed to destroy the corner of your field.
Right.
And it further says the Oniva la'yer tazovasam. You have to leave them over for the poor person, for the stranger, and so on. Right. They're the ones who are entitled to it. So it says, Dimashkachas lo bekima velakima. Yes, we could say that, yeah, here it's possible also to find kima velakima. Let's say he destroyed it, and the Bezdin says to him, look, you have hereby robbed the poor people, so this is what you have to do. And if he refuses to do it, then in that case they could give him Malkus for refusing to do it, right?
Right.
Or bitla, right? We would assume that this is also a case, or where it's also possible to apply the idea that he destroyed the possibility by destroying the field, right? Did none. So they say, no, not necessarily. Because we have already learned, that happens to be in the Baraisa, that mitzvahs payah, the mitzvah, the right way, in other words, to fulfill the mitzvah of the corner of the field,
is lahafrish min hakoma. It's to set aside from the standing grave. Koma, you know, it's from the word kum, kum. In other words, what is standing, standing grave, okay?
Oh, listen, this isn't, it's not a
head,
it's not
kema. Oh, no, kama. It's koma, right, min hakoma. Okay? Now, what happens, lo hifrish min hakoma? Let's say he did not set aside from the standing grain, then it says mafrish bin ha'omrin. In that case, he sets it aside a certain amount from the sheaves. In other words, he's already cut down everything, right?
Okay, yeah.
But right now it has sheaves lying on the ground. So he has to designate a certain amount of sheaves and say, this is what would have been standing in the corner of the field, and this goes to the poor people. All right? What happens if lo hifrish bin ha'omrin? Let's say he didn't do that. Then mafrish bin akri. Then in that particular case, he does it from the kri. By kri, they mean the heap, which is formed by you take the you know, the grain, and you give a good beating to it. You
after thresh,
right?
Thresh.
After thresh, right? And then you know you take the grain itself, and you know you make heaps of it. Prior, of course, you know, before you're going to mill it, okay? So, as long as ad shelo mera, as long as you didn't smooth out the piles to make them look nice and neat. This is what the procedure was in those days, that after they cut the sheaves, then, you know, they had to thresh them,
right.
And they gathered the grain, the kernels itself, together, right? And then they made very neat piles. They made piles, and they had to make them nice and smooth, okay? This is the way they did it. All right.
The only way that you could condition that, though, is that it would be handled not by the poor, meant for the poor.
It's meant for the poor, exactly.
Meant for the poor, but somebody else had to seek the justice.
Correct.
For the poor.
Right. Let's say this is my field, okay? So I say, this corner I designate is going to be for the poor, okay? Some people even would designate four corners. Okay, then that is already being very, very generous. Okay, but at least one corner of the field had to be set aside for the poor. So he says, okay, this amount. If you remember, we say in the morning, "Eil devarim shein lahem shiur," right? These have no fixed measure, and the very first thing that we mention is hapeah.
Yeah.
Okay, in other words, whether the peah should be like this in size or should it be like this in size. This is already dependent upon the generosity of the balabas, okay? And naturally, if he's more generous, he sets aside a bigger area over here. But again, if he didn't do it, so the next step, as we said, has been omrim. He's cut it down, they're in sheaves, but he could still say, this amount of sheaves over here, I designate for the poor, and then the rest of it, you know, he can do whatever he wants with it. But let's say he didn't do it, so we say that in that case, you know, you take the grains, that the kernels, you know, that you have, and you stack them up in very neat piles and so on, and he can decide, you know, let's say this pile belongs to the poor people or something like that, okay? And then, of course, you know, he's permitted to, you know, to use the rest.
Like an organization that would do that. You know, to control that. Who are the poor, and who are the ones overseeing that this man is doing what he's supposed to do?
Okay, Sam, you asked a very good question.
Okay, no, it's all right.
No. So you should know, I mean, that in the Mishnah, the end of Peah, they speak about, you know, who is a poor person, and what is he entitled to, and public assistance. Okay? If he doesn't have enough for this, then it's your obligation to provide him for it. For example, a poor person has to be provided with enough food in order to be able to have 14 meals during the week. And according to another opinion, it should be 15 meals because on Shabbos he's entitled to have Shabbos Shudas also.
You had a good one.
So I had to give enough, you know, help to a poor person to
You could get other ramifications, you know. And if I was a poor, I'd rather not have him leave the corner of the field because I could get another stage out of him where he's already done the work.
Well,
no, I'm only, you know, but there is the truth.
Okay, you're thinking, but from the point of view of what the Torah is considering, the rest of it, you should do it the right thing to begin with.
It's best to get it as soon as possible because
you may not get it at all. Do the right thing to begin with.
exactly.
What's the word for charity? Is it
charity?
Mahi or charity food? You know, like
You're thinking about Tom Cui.
Tom Cui, right.
Right.
Tom Cui, thank you.
Tom Cui is where people would contribute food. And, you know, into a common, like a common food basket or something like that, okay? And then the Gaboyim would distribute, you know, the food that had been collected to the poor people. And as I say, the Mishnah Peah has, you know, different degrees, how much you own in order to be able to be entitled to this amount, and how much you own to be entitled to this amount, and so on. But it says that if a person doesn't need it, and he does, you know, take charity at the expense of the public,
he's stealing from the people who need it.
His punishment will be that eventually he will become so poor that he'll have to.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
It's got to develop. That's got to develop on the
right. There are so many things, you know, that are very relevant to what's going on today. I mean, the whole idea, you know, charity and the means and stuff like that. Can you do things on your own, you know? And the final analysis, let's not forget.
Who is entitled?
Right. And, you know, think always in terms of what the Rambam had to say about the 8 degrees of charity. The lowest degree of charity is simply, you know, a poor man comes to you and you give it to him. You're fulfilling a mitzvah. But if you can do it, you know, for example, without causing him, you know, to be embarrassed, right, and things like that. And then he says, what is the highest degree of charity? Highest degree of charity is that you enable that person to become self-supporting.
Oh, yeah.
That's the highest degree.
Tell me, how did you decide this?
Hey, I read this Jewish in people had it figured out right.
I read this in
that's
Israeli
right.
newspaper about a Beit Tamsui. Russian woman, there's a restaurant in Tel Aviv set aside that olim that had no money could go there and get a meal every day, right? So she went with others every day and she went for a meal. One day, the restaurant had a banquet as part of their private thing. So she came in and she was hungry, so she took something from the banquet. So the owner of the restaurant forbade her to come back in again for the tanghui, for the how would you have decided this? Say you were a judge.
I don't know. I'd have to think about it. If she was desperate and poor, then I would say that he should still.
Sure, why deprive her of food for the rest of her life?
Okay.
All right,
let's finish.
Just these things are relevant that you say. Don't think for a minute that it doesn't not reflect it.
All right. So, Achon Omer, right? Until the point, as long as he didn't smooth it out.
Yeah.
Now, what happens if he already miracle, he did smooth it out? And in that case, at this particular point, it now becomes subject to taking tithes. Until this point, you see, payah is not subject to tithes.
I see.
Something given to the poor people, and so you, as an owner, don't have to tithe it. But once you smooth it out and so on, it's ready for you, then in that case, you have to begin at this particular point to give tithe. So you would have to give a tithe for the poor, you would have to set aside. Okay? Ma'asir v'dosimba, right? Kidda Rabbi Yishmael, even as in the opinion of Rabbi Yishmael, the Omar who said, Af Mafrish bin Ha'isa. Rabbi Yishmael says that even if it's already been made into dough, you can still give a portion of that dough to whom?
Very interesting.
To the poor person.
Okay? Very interesting.
Yeah. Well, Rabbi Yishmael, Nami Mishkachas lo Diachal Isa. So now they ask the question of Rabbi Yishmael and say, hey, look, isn't it possible that he destroyed the whole thing by eating up the dough?
He ate up the whole bread, the whole thing.
Elazos, the Odacheres. Aho. So they say, well, where Rabbi Yochanan said, you know, that in the case of the bird, and there was one other, this is what he was referring to. If the guy actually went ahead, in other words, and ate up the dough, so it was impossible, you know, to fulfill, then in that case he would be guilty of what?
Bitlo,
below
Bitlo. Right. Okay, so that's the other case, according to this. Okay. But what started the whole thing? The whole thing got started with the business of the Ones.
So he says,
all right, so let's get back to the Ones, he says, okay? What about that? So he says, of all Ones, lo. But the Ones is not the second case. The Hecha Aminun Adas rather than Lo HaFora. Because you brought me that, you know, that if with the consent of everybody, he said he refuses, you know, that he's taking a vow that he had nothing to do with her, etc., right? And you say that if he takes such a vow publicly, then in that case there cannot be any releasing him from the vow, right? Eino hafora. So they say, no, that only refers to the Dvar HaRishus. That would only refer to something where it's only a voluntary act of the Dvar Mitzvah, but where the Torah itself gave a mitzvah, a command that says that it must be obeyed. Of course, as a married man, he has a command to what? To take care of his wife's needs, to provide for her financially, to give her clothing, and to have relations with her, and so on. In that case, he's not allowed to take an oath against him, right? The Dvar Mitzvah, Yeshua HaFarad. In other words, they say, your neder is no neder, okay? And they bring a little interesting case. Keho Dahahu Makrid Dardike says, there was a certain teacher of kids, Dahava Posha Biyaduka, who was very severe with the kids, and as Rashi explains, what did he do? He beat them a little too hard. A teacher could beat a little bit, you know, after all. Has to instruct them to make sure that they're obeying and that they turn out to be good citizens.
We got beaten.
But he starts to abuse them. So what happened in that particular case? So because he was, you know, so mean to them, so Adve Rav Acha put him under a neder, and that he's not allowed to teach children. Okay? So what happened then? Hadre Ravida. So along came Ravida, and he gave absolution to him. In other words, he restored him. Why? Because he says, the Lovish Takach, the Dayek Kabosev. There was no teacher who was as good as he was. Even though he was cruel, but at least he got the point across and he gave him the right instruction and everything else. So on that basis, Ravina released him from the vow. Okay, I think we'll stop at this point. I'm a little bit tired, and anyway, we start with the new Indian over here. Okay?
All right.
So, Mirza Hashem, we shall continue over here from Zion on his
base.
Right? Start the new one next week. And we'll meet again after Mincha Maariv next week.
Okay.
Yeah. May.
All right.
Happens to be the night of Yud Gimel Iyar.
Gimel Iyar.
I think we have to give a little justice to the Hebrew date as well, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know it's May Day, but I don't know what Yud Gimel Iyar is.
Well, it's the day before Yud Dalet Iyar. But Yud Dalet Iyar is a special day, you know. That's Pesach Sheni. Yeah, so
Yud
Dalet, Friday.
Yeah.
So Friday we'll omit Tatan. You know, Pesach Sheni is the day that the Torah gave in order to give you a makeup, you know.
Makeup.
Yeah. Right. You weren't able to bring the Korban Pesach and need it in its proper time, then in that case you had a makeup date. And the makeup date was the 14th day of the Iyar. And of course, the 18th day of the year, that's Lag BaOmer and so on. So, you know, we're getting into towards the tail end.
So, you were traveling on Pesach, you couldn't prepare Pesach. That's the time to prepare Pesach. So,
you were far away from the Beis HaMikdash, you couldn't make the pilgrimage over there. Or if you were in a state of Tumah.
Would you require the matzah that day or what? Or just the Korban Pesach?
No, it's written specifically on matzah, some rorim yochluhu. You have to eat the Korban Pesach together with matzah and morah. But the only thing is, you're only required to do it over there in the Beis HaMikdash and so on. But in your own home, you can have chometz.
Oh.
Yeah, that you can have. but you know, for the Korban Pesach had to be together with matzahs and Mor, right? And that's the quotation that we read, you know, for Hillel sandwich.
Yeah.
Or matzahs and Mor. In other words, that for the Korban Pesach had to be together with matzahs and Mor. Yeah. Okay, so the reason I took the chumashim is because we're going to have to go into a counting game in a couple of minutes to see how many sets of malchus a person should get. Okay.
I thought it was 39.
Well, 39 is the official count, but that's only for one set of malchus.
Excuse me. I thought
maybe you'll get two sets, three sets, four sets of malchus.
Oh, okay. And so
all depends. We'll see in a minute what the problem is over there. All right. So, at any rate, getting back to the Mishnah at the beginning of the Perek, you know, where the entire Mishnah was given for this particular chapter. So, it says over there that, you know, Voechon, Nevelis, and Trefos, right? If you eat Nevelis and Trefos. Now, of course, the question is, what is the difference between Nevela and what's a Trefa? Okay? The traditional distinction that we make between nevelas and trefas is that a nevela is an animal that was not slaughtered. It's an animal that started out as a kosher animal, but when they came to shecht it, something went wrong with the shechting. We have Gemara in Chulin, they speak about halacha l'Moshe and Sinai. In other words, a tradition that goes back to Moshe and HaSinai. When it comes to Shechita, it has to be Kashir Tzavisicha, accordance with the way God gave oral instructions to Moshe Rabbeinu, which applies to such things as, for example, it has to be within a certain area within the neck. It applies to the fact that you're not allowed to exert pressure. You're not allowed to dig in with the point of the knife into it. You're not allowed to cause any tearing of the knife. I mean, you have to cut, but you're not allowed to tear, and so on. So that all these different things are halacha l'moshe m'sinai. Okay. Now, if anything went wrong with the slaughtering process, then automatically the animal becomes a nevela. So, as I say, this is the usual translation of the word nevela. Okay. What is a trefa? Trefa is an animal that, strictly speaking, is diseased. We speak about different possibilities of things that may go wrong within the organs of the animal's body, and that renders the animal a trefa. Okay? I mean, this is the reason why to this very day, one of the things that we have to do is to examine such things as, for example, if it's, let's say, an animal that you've shechted, right, and you have to go and examine the lungs to make sure that there's no perforation in the lung. Because if there is a perforation, then in that particular case, that makes the animal trefa. Okay, but there are other things too. As for example, if you would find, let's say, in a chicken, you would find something wrong. Or let's say inside broken foot is a possibility. Certainly, let's say if you found, let's say, a needle inside that had perforated, you know, let's say either the goggle, or the pupik or something like that, and so on. So all these things, you know, would render the fowl trafe. Okay, so that technically is what is the difference between the veil and trafe. But of course, in a general use of language, you know, so nevelas and trefas means anything which is not a kosher behavior, okay.
Yeah, also technically, doesn't nevela also apply to animals found dead in the field? Animals that have died by methods.
Yes, if they died by themselves, for example, right, they become nevela, absolutely so. Correct. Yes. Because there it's related to the word which simply means a corpse.
For some reason, the word nevela entered the jargon as Amyla. Somehow the word trefa never became attached to any ill repute, but to say somebody's a nevela.
A nevela.
Well,
yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that expression.
Don't forget, you know, that
he's a reject.
Actually, they do say
nevela.
When they're referring to somebody
who says an
nevela, a heretic. When you refer to as a trifa,
right?
And a nevela is a very abominable individual.
Right. There's no question. I mean, as I say, as far as the common language is concerned, you know, the Vedas includes anything which is not kosher, period.
So trefa doesn't necessarily refer to, let's say, unclean animals that are forbidden to eat.
Specifically, doesn't.
In the Torah, an animal which you're not allowed to eat
is referred to
because
as
it's of an unclean species is called a tomato over there.
A tomato.
Right, you see. They don't use the same language. But as I said, I'm using the technical distinction, but now, as far as everybody is concerned, the veil of trefa, it's all, I mean, if it was, trefa means it's the opposite of a kosher, period.
Okay.
This is the way we use it today. Pardon me?
A hostess Twinkie,
right, okay. Well, the difference between an Oreo and a Hydrox.
Okay. So which one is okay?
The Hydrox. That's kosher. That's the kosher version.
Yeah, Oreos.
Now there are lots of other kosher versions, but that's the original kosher version. Okay. All right. So at any rate, if a person eats either in the Velas or Trefa, says the Mishnah, or Shkotzim or Amosim, again, I mean, we use these terms practically interchangeably, you know, Shkotzim or Amosim. But technically, Sheketz is anything which is abominable by itself. And Remes is anything that, you know, the swarming creatures or that creeps upon the ground and so on and so on. This is the Remes, okay? But there's Remes on the ground, the Remes in the water, and so on and so forth, as we'll see, okay? So, again, Shkotz and Ramosin, you know, we sort of take them into the same category, okay? Of course, the word sheketz, I mean, this is how we get the word sheketz, obviously. Right, I mean, shkotzim, right? Sheketz, shkotzim. So, I mean, so you know, a lot of these words have become part of the Yiddish vocabulary, but not in the original sense, but the extended sense, okay? Which happens with a lot of words in the vocabulary that we use. Okay, so at any rate, what is the punishment naturally for that? Well, everything that we had in the Mishnah on Yud Gimel up to this particular point, we know that actually there were two different penalties that were involved. One penalty is the penalty of Kores, and the other one is the penalty of Malkus. Okay? Question is only, you know, if you get Kores, do you get Malkus or not? Depends upon what the sin is and so on and what you did. Okay? But what was the difference, as we saw, between Kores and Malkus? Kores means that you come to an untimely end because Lebeinu Shalelam, or the heavenly court, is going to put an end to your life at an untimely time. This is technically what the punishment is. And then you have another one, Misabtei Shamayim, which is equated with the idea that Ariri, a person will die childless or something like that. Needless to say, it doesn't mean every person who is childless, therefore, you know, is that, but, you know, if it's a punishment, then it's a punishment. Leolenu, I mean, there are a lot of people who would love to have a child, and they're good, they're yidden, and they obey the mitzvahs, and they study Torah and everything else, but never, you know, they can't have a child. But from the point of view, you know, of enumerating punishments and so on, all right. Now, here, for eating these things, the punishment is not Kores. Punishment is only Malkus. Why? Because you've disobeyed it. A lot. Kores says not to. Lo sechelu, right? You're not allowed to eat them, and you let the head eat it. Okay. So, getting back to our text right now in the Gemara. Okay? Omer Rav Yehuda. You see that? Okay. So Rav Yehuda said, Haiman du ochel b'niso, debei karbo malkinin lei. Okay? He says that the person eats b'niso. Now the question is, what does b'niso mean? So Rashi, we'll take a look over there. B'niso debei karbo, do you see it? It's up above, it's a little bit higher than where we have it. It's roughly about 4 or 5 lines higher. So he finds that this tolas, it's a worm. Hanim says bichrov, right? It's a worm that is found within the cabbage. Shekorin Selah. Haven't really quite figured out what the French is over there, but that's all right. Rashi knew it. But anyway, as we see, he says that if you eat a worm inside a cabbage, then automatically you're subject to the penalty of getting malchus because you had no business, you know, eating such a thing. Okay? If we take a look at Tosfos, which is opposite over there, so Tosfos disputes Rashi's interpretation. Says Benisa the Beikarbi, says Peirush Sakuntris, he says Rashi's commentary says Toilas Anim says Bechrov, right? Benikre Sela. But he says the Kosher. But he says I find it difficult to accept that interpretation. The Maikam Ashmolot, because what is he telling us? Pshita the Sheretz Gomor. It's no question that if you find a worm and you eat a worm, it certainly is a Sheretz. It's a creeping creature. So that we know we're not allowed to eat. So why is he singling it out? So we favorished Rabbeinu Tam. That's what that the abbreviation over there means. So that therefore, Rabbeinu Tam interpreted as follows. He says Binisa. He says this is kamo dog koton animso bachrisha. Says this is like a little fish that is found in an area where you've plowed. And you have a furrow over there, and you know, as the plow goes in, all of a sudden, what do? You discover like a tiny fish over there.
Fish.
Tiny fish is what he says. And he teaches us the apal gav. So, I mean, what is the difference, in other words? What difference does it make to us whether it's a fish or whether it's a worm? So he says, the apal gav, the nymphs of the mayim, hoyamutor, says, if this fish were in the water, it would be a permissible fish. The fish is lo katzkatzim, because it does have scales. So afilo hochi, nevertheless, he says, loke, he gets malchus in this particular case, if he would eat this little creature from an area which has been plowed, in other words, from dry land. Apal gav di'i hevi b'mayim tohi, even though if it were in the water, it were kosher, would be acceptable.
Puzzling
Tosfos? Huh?
Puzzling Tosfos?
It's a puzzling Rabbeinu Tam, isn't it? But on the other hand, I'm sure that Rabbeinu Tam had come across such creatures crawling, you know, in the, certainly I can imagine, I mean, let's say that if you have, let's say, you know, soil which is moist. So maybe there's some kind of creatures.
There are. I mean, there are any number of things, species that can survive as little ponds dry up. They can survive in mud.
Right. This is what I'm thinking. I say
the water returns, but the simple interpretation of this Rabbeinu Tam is that somehow this very same species, depending on its environment,
location,
will have a different identity as being permissible or forbidden.
Correct.
And that strikes one as a very, very difficult notion.
Right. Well, listen, the Rabbeinu Tam had his reasons for it, obviously. Because why didn't he accept the
Rashi's?
Because he said that was too obvious.
Right.
For that, we didn't have to have a special statement of Rabbi Yehuda. You see, that's the reason why. And incidentally, I don't have to tell you how today people have become very, very matmir with all kinds of leafy vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cabbage, lettuce. I mean, what you go through, for example, preparing romaine lettuce for the Seder, stripping this and soaking this and doing everything else, and so on, in order to make sure that there isn't anything that you can only see with a microscope. Because it's invisible to the naked eye, but they want to be very marked with these things. And of course, that has now given rise to an industry, both in Eretz Israel and in America.
The professional cabbage inspectors.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Tend run into those people.
In Brooklyn, you can buy
broccoli.
Broccoli is another.
Another one.
Asparagus and so on. Yeah, I mean, these are all suspect vegetables today. But all I can tell you is buy potatoes. Potatoes and tomatoes.
They have a bug in a potato too.
But they do have now. In Brooklyn, I saw it first.
Inspected cabbage.
Right.
Inspected romaine lettuce.
Yeah, right. And they have like the forms of lettuce and so on and so forth that you can buy in a store that are grown specially and inspected and everything else, and then packaged and so on. in Eretz Yisrael, what they've done.
You mean they take leaf by leaf a part of a piece of a head of lettuce and inspect it?
Yeah.
And they put that together. They have a different system over there.
You. Huh? And you buy it.
They have, for example, in the Gush Katif, which is an area, as you know, it's it borders on the Gaza region. And I admire the guts of people who are living over there. But it's very, very lush. They grow all kinds of vegetables over there. It's warm, it's temperate, and everything else. So that very often they have things ready over there before the market further up north in Eretz Israel is ready. At any rate, one of the industries that they have now is that they grow it in plants in hothouses, in soil over there, where, you know, that the sand in which it grows is, you know, it's checked to make sure that it's not infested with anything else and so on. And then they package it and they sell it. So this is the kind of vegetables that they had. My daughter's area over there, which is a very, very firm area where nobody would eat, you know, without them. So, we can understand then this business over here about the beniso de vekarba, right? The worm inside the cabbage. All right. So at any rate, he says he does the malkinale. What is his punishment? They give him malchus. Now, why does he deserve malchus? So the answer is because this is a case, this worm, of being sheretz hashoretz al ha'aretz, right? This is a creeping creature that crawls on the earth. Now, in order to get the full import of this, we'll have to take a look right now at the end of Parsha Shmini.
There's a Tosfos Shantz in the back, but it's an interesting variant of the Rabbeinu Tam.
Yeah, you could.
Just the only difference is first he calls it Kaniella instead of Tzila, and second he says it's impossible for
52.
Such a creature to live. It's impossible for such a creature to be Miskayim. It's untenable in that environment, and that's why it's not kosher.
Mm-hmm. The mean dog who writes. He also agrees, yeah. The Yeshua Snapi Kaskas is right. The Nimso Beno Machresh, right. The Koshev Le Sheretz Mishum the Yeshol is fine in cave and shame of the mind. Okay. But what kind of a little fish this is, I don't know. I'm not familiar with it myself. But all I can say is that they must have seen something, you know, which reminded them of it and so on. All right. The end of Parsha Shmini, if you remember, it deals with, first of all, what are the kosher animals, what are the kosher fish, and what fowl can we eat? Or actually, it doesn't mention what we can eat, but says what fowl we can't eat, right? The Asela Teshaktsu bin Hawo, right? Los Yeoklu Shekatsay, and so on, okay. All right. Let's take a look. Alright, so first we had, you know, the animals, right? And of course it says, right, you're not allowed to eat from their meat, nor can you even touch their flesh, okay? The carcasses. This is the use in the veil in that particular sense, right? Because tmeim heim lochem. But then afterwards, what does it say about the fish? The fish, you take a look at the end of Pasuk Yud, right? Right, anything which does not have the fins and the scales, right? Whether it's in waters, you know, whether it's in the ocean or whether it's in streams, right? Mikol sheretz hamayim, anything that crawls in the water, right? Or swarms in the water, mikol nefesh hachaya shebamayim, sheketz heim lachem. So we have already sheketz mentioned over there, right? And then it's written the Yeselet to Shaktsu min Ho'ev, right? That these are, you are to consider them abominable, or you shall detest them, as he translates over them. Bo Yochlu Sheketz Heim, because they are Sheketz. And then there's a whole list of them, and so on and so forth, right? And then, after that, if we take a look,
He then goes on with Pasuk Chof on the next page over there. He speaks about Kol Sheretz Ha'ov, Ra'ach Abba Sheketz Hulachem. So this is another category then, Sheretz Ha'ov. In other words, a Sheretz which is winged. It's winged, swarming creature, okay? And the only exception is certain types of the locusts are permitted. But anything else, no. The Kol Sheretz Ha'ov, Lo Abba Raglaim, Sheketz Hulachem, right. And so on. And then afterwards he says, and so on, so forth, right? So, yeah. And then it continues on page the following page with verse 29, right? Right? These are various things that are also considered tome, and they are creeping creatures, and they mention such things like reptiles and turtles and things like that. Okay, you take a look at some of these things, a gecko, a lamb, a crocodile, the lizard, sand lizard, chameleon, etc., etc., okay? And, okay. And then page, again, verse 41, V'chol ha-sheretz ha-sheretz al-horetz, right? If this is sheretz which creeps on the ground, again, sheketz hu lo yo'achel, and so on and so forth, okay? And then it continues, sheretz ha'chlum ki sheketzim. So as we see, all these things are not allowed to eat, and then it says, al teshaksu eslav sheretzeichem b'chol ha'sheretz ha'sheretz. Do not make your own souls detestable, if you wish, okay, by having anything to do with it. So it's not only, you know, eating, but also it's not the act of eating alone which is prohibited, but also the fact that we're not allowed to even contaminate our souls with these things, you see, which is already an added category. And so now what do we see? We see that for sheretz ha'oretz, we are actually, if we were to eat it, we would violate it two lavin. One lav is not to eat, and the other one is that we would be mishakis is matfis, we'd be contaminating ourselves, okay? So this is what he's saying right now. It says that if we were to eat this worm, then he gets malchus mishum sheretz ha-sheretz al-horetz, alright, which as we see involves two different things, as Rashi points out over there. It says, no, he doesn't point that over here. Okay. Then, we come to the next thing. It says over there, right, Ahuda Ochal, and he brings a case study. Case study is, there was a certain man who ate this benisa, he ate the worm, the vekaber inside the cabbage, or, if you wish, the little fish that had no business
being there.
Benagde Rav Yehuda, and Rav Yehuda gave him malchus, okay, for doing so. Because I have to tell you, Rav Yehuda was not in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Yehuda was in Bovel. Now, strictly speaking, malchus is a knas, the original, and the Torah has to be only in Eretz Yisrael, because only the courts in Eretz Yisrael could levy certain punishments. Capital punishment, for example, could not be levied outside of Eretz Yisrael. Okay? Malchus and Knasen, various Knasen, as for example what the Torah itself specified, like the case of the 100 pieces of silver or the 50 pieces of silver, you know, remember the Motzi Shemra and the Mefata, the Yonis of Mefata, and so on and so forth, right? That's a Knas in the Torah. So that cannot be executed outside of Eretz Yisrael. But nevertheless, the Beis Din outside of Eretz Yisrael did have the authority to give a good shmeis to somebody if he disobeyed something, and they wanted to make an example of this person to the community so that nobody should, you know, be tempted to do the same thing. Okay, so Rabbi Yehuda found this guy who was doing it, and he ordered him beat. Abaye. So Abaye adds another. It says, Ochal putisa. If you eat a putisa, then lo karabah. Then in that case, you're going to get four sets of malchus. Why do you get four sets of malchus? Well, first of all, what is a betisa? So Rashi simply says, Bola sheretz hamayim. This is some creeping thing that goes in the water. Some say that it's a lizard or something like that. Okay? Others say it's a little frog. Take your pick. Nobody really knows Call what the
shrimp.
Meaning of the word putisa is.
Call it shrimp.
Call shrimp. Okay,
Call
good,
shrimp.
Good. Call it a shrimp. Very good.
We'll like that better. Shrimp. That isn't that disgusting.
Right. Right. So at any rate, the Lekabu, you get four sets of malchus. And as Rashi explains, why? Because, first of all, he says, Shnei lavin kisun b'sheretz hamayim, right? He says, there are two different thou shalt not written in connection with those things that swarm in the water. Echod, he says, b'toris kehadim, one of them is in the book of Vayikra. The Echod, the Mishnah Torah, and the other one is to be found in, Deuteronomy. Remember, Mishnah Torah is Deuteronomy. Of course, again, if you remember that when we have the parsha about, kosher and treif in Shemini, but we have an abridged version of the same thing also in Parsha Re'eh, where there's a repetition of some of these things that we've had, okay? So, not only that, but Shnei Lavin Kesuvin B'Sheretz Tam, and also, we already mentioned that there are two Lavin that are written concerning eating any kind of a sheretz, whatever it may be. Lo Shashashu Es Nafshaseichem, right? You're not to allow to defile, to contaminate your souls, b'chol ha'sheretz l'sheretz, and then l'so tamu b'hem, right? U'mashma ben sheretz l'mayim, ben sheretz oretz harei dalet. So, if you eat a sheretz in the water, so you're not only violating the two original ones, but you're also violating two other psukim, we're not allowed to, so therefore how many sets of malchus do you deserve? Four of them. All right? So we continue, we'll multiply a few more yet. Okay.
So how do they get from 2 to 4 votes to the national?
Because there are two lavin as far as sheretz,
right,
in general. Okay.
Right.
And now, if it's sheretz hamayim, so there are two more additional lavin that are written in the Torah that say you're not allowed to have any sheretz that's in the water. Okay. So if that's the case, so you add these two specifically for the sheretz hamayim to the two of sheretz bichlal in general, in that case you deserve four sets of malchus. Okay. Namola, what if you eat an ant? So in that case, lo kechamish. Then how many sets do you deserve? Five of them. Why?
What if you eat what?
An ant.
A-N-T.
Right. Right. Rashi. Namola. It says, Bola namola chaya. You swallowed a living ant, okay?
A living ant.
A living ant, even if it's a dead ant, however.
Right.
Because there's a question as to whether the word chai over here means what it means literally, or does
ant
it mean,
alive.
For example, a whole one, as compared to a half, because we'll see pretty soon that there's a question about what if you make a little jam out of ants?
Indeed. Oh. Jam out of ants.
Okay. So at any rate, if you eat,
you know what I saw was a real delicacy. What's it called? The larva.
Yeah.
Of a very large beetle.
Uh-huh.
There's a picture. It's about the size of a good sized, not a Frankfurter, but not a sausage. What do you call it?
Sausage.
Link
sausage.
Much bigger than a frank.
Yeah.
It's white, and they roast it. It's real.
You mean like a big borscht or something like that?
Like a borscht, right.
Yeah,
it looks exactly
yeah.
like a big borscht. It's a it's a larva of a giant beetle in the tropics. Well,
Africa, places, New Guinea, places, those places where they still have people who pose for National Geographic.
Very nutritional,
Well, I know that there are people, they make this business about being out in the wilderness,
Survival.
Survival, right. And they have to eat rattlesnakes and things like that. Right. Well, with him, it was a question of life and death. No question. Yeah.
Well, you're right. You're allowed to do it then.
In that case, it was a question of Pikuach Nefesh, yes.
Pikuach Nefesh.
Yeah. All right, so Rashi says, Vola de Molochaya, right. Hoil.